From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Fake news is real. It's an actual thing, a kind of illicit industry. There are people sitting behind computers making crap up. But why? The term fake news has taken on a political dimension these days, but it's often misapplied. President Trump gets it wrong when he calls the New York Times fake news for an article he believes to be biased or inaccurate. The journalist Alexios Matsarlis says the term has come to mean everything and nothing. It's been co-opted for use in the election on the right and the left. And he says people are making up news. They're fabricating news, not for propaganda purposes usually, but to make money. So today in the program, we're talking about what fake news is and what it isn't, and just how much difference facts make anyway to the way we believe what we want to believe. Join us after the news.
Hey, Benjamin Bombard here from Radio West. All this month, we're asking a favor of you, our listeners. Tell someone, anyone, about a podcast that you think they might love. Tell your mom, tell a friend, tell your dentist, tell someone who might not even know what a podcast is. Anyway, help spread the podcast love. Easy way to do that, hit the share button on your podcast app. It usually looks like a half-finished triangle with the three dots. And use the hashtag tripod, that's try with a Y. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for listening. And here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You have seen fake news. We all have. You have been sucked in by a fake news article. We probably all have. And that's when it works for the lowlives sitting at a computer somewhere making stuff up. It's when you click on that article that seems too fantastic to be true, and then you find yourself inside some weird website that has the fake article in it somewhere, but it's the ads in that website that make these guys the money. That's fake news. What is not fake news is an article that is biased or inaccurate. The problem is these days the term gets thrown around a lot, and so today on the program we're discussing what you do about false stories, because this part is complicated too. What is fake news? What isn't fake news? And why it is, when faced with facts, it's incredibly difficult to get someone to change their mind. Joining us first on the program is Alexios Matsarlis. He is the director and editor of the International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute, and the editor, I should mention, of that. And he's joining us today from a studio at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. And Alexios Matsarlis, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess I want to begin with the most basic question. What exactly is fake news? Because it seems silly, because it seems so self-evident, but you say the term has come to be distorted, means everything, means nothing these days. What is fake news?
Yeah, I mean, fake news had a meaning last summer, right, when it was being used primarily by media watchers to mean something very specific. Entirely fabricated content produced not really for political purposes, but to game the algorithms of big tech platforms, primarily Facebook, in order to reach large audiences that would click on the content and make ad revenue to its creators. Since the election, in part because of how more generally the media covered the topic and misdefined it, and then thanks also to the intervention of President Trump, it has stopped meaning that. But in that strict definition, it is still a problem and it should still be tackled.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned, and I want to dig in a little bit to how this industry, if you want to put it that way, works. But the purpose of these stories, at least generally speaking, they're not about propaganda. They're not about politics. They're just about making people money, right?
Yeah, I mean, the meme right now is that there's teenagers in Veles, a small town in Macedonia. And it's a meme because there were a bunch of websites. Craig Silverman at BuzzFeed found this out. A bunch of websites registered in the Balkans. And it was just adolescents that realized that producing this kind of content would make them an easy buck.
Right.
But beyond that region, there were sites like that in the U.S. and the Philippines, around the world.
Say something about that money-making aspect for just a minute, if you would. When you manage to draw someone to your website to, you know, clickbait, to get them to click on something, you get eyeballs, and advertisers will give you money for the eyeballs.
Correct. Yeah. Right? I mean, just up, you know, load your website with a bunch of ads, and if you are able, through sensationalist headlines and totally bogus stories that, however, attract people to open them, you are bringing in easy cash. And it's easy cash because, reminder, you've made up these stories altogether and you really don't care about where they go and how realistic they are. You just need them to be clicked on. So it's the return on investment was, especially before the election, quite high.
You mentioned there was this BuzzFeed story that showed one fake news site was making something like $600 per day for just a single story.
Yeah, I think the number was in a week, but yes, absolutely.
In a week,
and before the elections, there were stories again on BuzzFeed or in the Washington Post showing that some of these websites could make several thousand dollars. And so again, it's a pretty good business considering you're just making stuff up.
How far-reaching is this fake news part, and did it surprise you? It seems like a virus. Its capacity to kind of get into nooks and crannies and grow exponentially.
Yeah, I mean, the key component and the key difference for what happened in 2016 was that these creators very capably used the power of Facebook groups to reach these audiences, and they smartly realized that the newsfeed is based on essentially on turbocharging our confirmation bias. So our desire to see more of what already aligns with our beliefs. And so by providing this kind of content, the people would like it and share it more. And as you know, newsfeeds show you more of what you've liked and shared in the past.
Yeah.
And so it's a reinforcing circle that these organizations did quite well off.
The idea of fooling someone or suckering someone, that is nothing new. I guess that's as ancient as we as humans are, right?
Absolutely. And I think these headlines like attacking Facebook of being the ultimate evil, you know, this is human nature, right? So it's human nature that we're dealing with. Where Facebook had a responsibility was that instead of sort of providing an environment where this kind of stuff wouldn't do great, it seemed to have a series of ways in which fake news could reach much larger audiences than in the past. But again, in the past, we weren't able to measure how many people were engaging with fake news, right? We weren't able to know how many people thought the moon was made out of cheese or whether the landing was staged. So it's hard to compare. I guess what we can do is quantify it. And in 2016, we saw towards the closer to the election that these stories were getting more engagement than real news stories.
Yeah. I don't want to pick on the Salt Lake Tribune because I think there are a lot of legitimate news organizations that where you can, find your way to a fake news story. So if you click on, I had our producer, Benjamin Bombard, go in this morning and look on the Salt Lake Tribune website, go into an article, and there at the bottom, you'll see a series. In this particular case, I'm looking at a printout he made of so-called sponsored content. And there's one story that says failed celebs that now work regular jobs. And there's Julia Stiles, the actor, whose face is on that, who I happen to know is not working a regular job. She's still acting. So I'm guessing, well, that's fake, right? But here's the other one. It says Clinton empire collapses after this shocking new scandal. And it's connected to an organization that says Health Sciences Institute. Now, when you click on it, it just seems like a crazy article about Hillary Clinton's – it says Hillary Clinton's secret revenge, and it's a briefing about this big conspiracy theory. I don't even really want to get into it, to be quite honest. It's clearly ludicrous. But how is it that a fake news article – this is clearly fake news – ends up in the Salt Lake Tribune?
For sure. I mean, the – the short answer is because Salt Lake Tribune, like many other newspapers, have hived off responsibility for bringing those stories to external companies, and those external companies have not been pushed to do more in removing this kind of crap. But absolutely, I think you draw attention to what is a real problem. This isn't the responsibility only of Facebook. Media outlets are doing it through the sponsored content, but you know, also in the past with some not great reporting of their own.
Yeah.
Users have more to do to deal with this. Google itself isn't great about what information it features in its snippets. So we should not obsess with one source of the problem by any means. And you know, the media presumably has an even bigger responsibility, given that it builds its reputation entirely on the truthfulness of what it reports.
Right. And I should make it clear, again, it wasn't just the Salt Lake, not to tease out just the Salt Lake Tribune. I've seen the same kinds of content
on
the Deseret News and all over the place.
National newspapers, too, and not just local.
Yeah.
And stories like, you know, the Shark Tank person who was beaten up. Or, you know, we've seen them all. And it's there it is a little hypocritical for news execs to, on the one hand, speak on fake news conferences about how big the problem is and not acknowledge that there's some cleaning up to do on their own websites.
Okay, I want to ask you about the most outrageous example of a fake news story emerging into reality, I guess, is this crazy story that comes during the presidential election that the Hillary Clinton campaign was, and everyone knows this story, of course, that the Hillary Clinton campaign was somehow involved in this child sex trafficking ring and these small restaurants around the country. And one North Carolina man actually goes to a pizza joint in Washington, D.C. to self-investigate. That's the term that he used with authorities, self-investigate this story, and he ends up firing shots from his rifle. Now, we'll get to the question of whether you believe fake news has influenced the election. You don't necessarily, but what do you make of that story? Was it just an outlier, or is there any more significance to something like that?
I mean, even if it is an outlier, it's an extremely serious outlier, right? I do think there should be responsibility for people who, you know, bring others to commit crimes because of false content.
Yeah.
It's not new. Spurious allegations about a woman being some kind of witch on Facebook doing really well, I think, 3 or 4 years ago led to the woman in question actually being beaten to death in Brazil.
Yeah.
So there's been precedent, I think. They are few and far between. So I would also not over, while these are extremely scary anecdotes, they are anecdotes. So I wouldn't either extrapolate that fake news is somehow leading to an epidemic of people just doing outlandish stuff.
Yeah. Of course, the big question, or one of them anyway, is whether or not fake news has had significant political dimensions, whether or not these fake news creators are trying to, you know, influence geopolitics, or whether or not, on the other hand, they're just kind of trying to exploit people's political impulses and their confirmation bias to make a buck. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as we said at the top, these stories are mostly made for financial purposes, and so they're not setting out to do something. It's not mis or disinformation pushed by maybe foreign agents or by people in power or with money. These weren't trying to do something particular. And in fact, there has been a study by Stanford University that said that tried to quantify the impact that fake news could have had. It's a bit of a back of the napkin attempt. And it says that, you know, fake news would have had to have the same, you know, 5 times or 10 times, like, don't have it in front of me right now, but somewhere in that range, the impact of all TV ads to have had an impact on the election. And so, you know, that's a pretty big assumption to make. And I think the authors themselves are suggesting that we shouldn't be making that assumption. So it's, did it pollute our information ecosystem ahead of an important election where a lot of facts were being disputed? For sure. Did it reach a lot of people, millions of people? Of course. Did some of them believe it? Yes. But to say that it somehow made one candidate win or the other candidate lose is to make an argument out of thin air, because we just don't have data to support that.
John Herman of the New York Times wrote just after the election, let me quote this. He says, for many people, and especially opponents of Donald Trump, the attention paid to fake news and its role in the election has provided a small relief, the discovery of the error that explains everything, which is interesting and kind of ironic, don't you think?
Yeah, that I love all of that John Herman piece. I think he got the problem spot on in November, long before many others. And so I think that's important. I think a lot of the headlines that we're seeing that this is a post-truth or a post-fact era are also sort of offering solace to angsty liberal commentators who just can't get their heads around how this happened and therefore sort of justify this deus ex machina of like, oh my God, it must be that facts are suddenly irrelevant and don't matter anymore when suddenly, because this happened. So I think that's important. I think another part of that article, and I don't know if we were going to talk about it later, but Herman also says that you know, this was going to be weaponized and come back and haunt legitimate news organizations. So I think he definitely spoke the truth twice in that piece.
He said fake news as a shorthand will almost surely be returned upon the media tenfold.
Right.
What does he mean, though? What do you mean by that?
So, because the post-election coverage of the fake news from the media often conflated fake news with partisan news, such as Breitbart, and suddenly started making lists of all the kind of sites that maybe sometimes publish misleading or inaccurate information, it became this catch-all that essentially, to casual onlookers, so most readers, because most readers don't care that much about the media, it seemed to mean any news that is vaguely inaccurate or that I disagree with. And so the master communicator that is currently in the White House was able to pounce on this and use it famously in his press conference to shout down CNN as fake news, and has consistently used that term since to browbeat other media outlets. And so it was, I think the seed was planted when we, in the media itself, started referring to things that weren't fake news as fake news.
So we're all to blame in some ways. I mean, like a Fox News story, for example, that may distort a political issue, that's not fake news any more than Donald Trump calling a CNN story he doesn't agree with is fake news. So we shouldn't just be throwing this term around.
Correct. There are, you know, inaccurate stories. There are stories that need to be corrected. There is, you know, falsehoods. There's all kinds of ways to define stuff. But this idea that misleading articles or articles that we disagree with are entirely fabricated is really poisoning the well of an already pretty poisoned well, right? Because trust in the media is not very high. To the point where it's even coming back to haunt what I would say one of the most honorable practices of good journalism, which is to publish corrections.
Yeah. This gets to the question of fact-checking. I mean, more than a few of us have sent a Snopes.com article or a PolitiFact article to, you know, an aunt or a grandparent who sends you some kind of weird conspiracy theory. What about fact-checking now in the political era where we are now? I mean, fake news was something before the 2016 election. What is fact-checking now in the current, you know, landscape?
Yeah, I mean, it sits in a central tension because on the one hand, at least since the birth of factcheck.org in 2003, there has never been a political candidate as brazen with untruths as Donald Trump. And that did not seem to have harmed him. On the other hand, fact checkers have never been as popular in terms of traffic and audiences as they have in 2016. You know, PolitiFact, one of, you know, the Pulitzer Prize winning fact checking organization, they obtained, I think, 110 million page views last year. That's a lot of page views for a fact checking organization. Respondents were telling pollsters that they wanted the media to fact check. 60% of them said that they thought the moderator should fact-check the debate, which the Commission on Presidential Debates quite negligently ignored. And the 83% of them said the media should it's the media's role to fact-check. So we're sort of torn in between these two realities.
Let me ask you finally. It seems like what you're saying is that even though there are now challenges about facts, and we're coming to know more about how difficult it is, in fact, to change someone's mind, that we shouldn't give up. I guess that's what you're saying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in fact, the post-fact or post-truth meme is a meme. We have studies, and three of them came out recently, that indicate that when corrected, people change their minds. They may be more reticent to change their mind when it goes counter to their political belief. But a study published just earlier this month from Brandy Swire-Thompson at the MIT showed that correcting Trump voters on Trump misinformation did reduce their likelihood of believing that claim as true. So I don't know how we can be post-fact in a world where people's minds are changed by facts.
That's Alexios Montsarlis. He's the director of the International Fact-Checking Network, which is a project of the Poynter Institute. And he joined us today from a studio on the campus of the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. Alexios, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Doug.
We're going to take a break, and we'll come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about fake news, but also facts. And what do you do about false stories? Because this is when this gets really complicated. Even when faced with facts, it's incredibly difficult to get someone to change their mind. Joining us now in the program is Julie Beck. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic magazine, where she covers health and psychology. She recently wrote an article for The Atlantic about why it's difficult to get people to change their minds about certain things. The article is called "This Article Won't Change Your Mind." We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. And she's joining us today from the offices of The Atlantic in Washington, D.C. Julie Beck, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, happy to be here.
I want to begin with the story that you begin with in your article about a man by the name of Daniel Shaw, because it really gets us into how complicated this all is. Just give us a basic sense of this. He gets involved in this meditation center in New York, and then there's this big expose about the place published in a magazine in the New Yorker, and he sees the article. But talk about maybe how he reacts to that, because I think it's really telling.
Yeah, so most of this happened before the New Yorker article came out. But yeah, he got involved with this sort of meditation group, religion sort of thing. I think he's come to believe in the years since that they maybe have like cult-like qualities, but who's to say? But anyway, he finds it really beneficial, and he gets really into it, and he saves up his money, and he goes to India to sort of meet the guru and study with the guru where she is. And he kind of rises through the ranks and becomes very prominent in that group. And a lot of the things that ended up in the article, he sort of had heard rumors of when he was there, that the guru's predecessor, there were allegations of sexual abuse against him, that the guru was kind of forcibly ousting her brother, who was like her co-leader for a while. And he said to me, you know, he said, I decided to believe that those couldn't be true. So it was much, much more conscious than I think these kind of things often are, where he suspects she's lying and decides it doesn't matter because she's still the guru and he still trusts her and all this. And I think, you know, he did eventually learn about what was going to be in that article, and that's around the time that he decided to leave the organization. But he said, you know, it wasn't necessarily because of that. That was the culmination of sort of many years of a growing unease. So it wasn't like he saw the information and then, you know, that was that, and he changed his mind.
But the thing that's most interesting is how it is early on in this. He hears these rumors. He hears these rumors, you know, they seem to be consistent. And he realizes, at least at that time, that the truth doesn't necessarily matter. What is that? What's happening at that point in his mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very it really illustrates just, you know, how thoughtful he is, because I think that's something that happens to a lot of us, but we don't necessarily realize that we're doing it, which yeah. is that the identity that you have as a part of that group or as a follower of that guru or what have you, that is more important than what is true. And you're giving that person the benefit of the doubt, even if you suspect they're not being truthful with you, because it's too important. It's too dissonant to try to reconcile those things.
People, you say in the article, change their minds all the time about things when faced with contrary evidence. One of the really great examples is the weather. You know, you saw the weather forecast and or believe that it's going to be good, and then it rains, and you change your mind. But you say in the article, if the thing that you might be wrong about is a belief that's deeply tied to your identity or your worldview, you say that's different. Why is that different?
I mean, it's different because it just has so much more implications for who you are and how you see the world. Like, if it's raining, like, okay, you know, it's raining. It doesn't change much for me. But if the, you know, if another example is it like a belief in a behavior, right? So if I'm a smoker and I know that cigarettes can kill me, like, that's very dissonant, like, because I am doing it anyways. So it has deep implications, whether it's, you know, your religion, whether it's your political party, whether it's even just your family, if there are facts that sort of indicate that what you believe about those things might be wrong, or that maybe if you believed these things, you wouldn't want to be a part of that group anymore.
There's this really interesting study you refer to in the article. This was from 1967. And this sort of deals with the way we relate to what we want to believe or what we want to pay attention to. And this study involved these speeches that people would listen to that had this static involved. Explain this.
Yeah, so they just had people sit down and listen to speeches, and they were just kind of poor quality, like the static would kind of come in and out and whatever, and it was totally manufactured, but they had a button, and they were like, if you want to hear it more clearly, just press this button and it'll kind of reduce the static a little bit. And the speeches were, so one of the speeches was about smoking, right? It was either a speech that said, you know, smoking is linked to cancer, or a speech that was sort of disputing that link and saying it might not be linked to cancer. And they found that when people were smokers, they really wanted to hear about how it might not be linked to cancer. So they would press that button more and more. And if they were not smokers, then they would press the button more for the speeches that did link it to cancer. So they were very eager to tune in to the speeches that agreed with them.
You say in the article that when it comes to the things that people believe in, they actually see that the evidence that disagrees with that belief as being weaker, because, as you put it in the piece here, they're asking themselves fundamentally different questions when they're evaluating that evidence.
Yeah, so the question, you know, if you want to believe something, you say, can I believe it?
Yeah.
And if you get even one piece of evidence that gives you permission to believe it, then you're good to go. And if you don't want to believe it, you say, must I believe this? Like, do I have to believe this? And there's not a lot that you absolutely have to believe. Like, you have to believe it's raining if you're being rained on, I guess. But, you know, other than that, there's wiggle room, even if it's sort of not logically amazing, right?
Right. So we're just looking to confirm what we already believe. We're just looking for things that we get a notion in our minds and we're drawn to the things that confirm that, I suppose. The confirmation bias.
Yeah, I mean, the whole, you know, psychologists call it motivated reasoning, and yeah. There's so many things that go into it. It starts with, like, the static button. What do you even pay attention to? What are you even willing to look at or listen to? And then, you know, you can argue against evidence. You can just disbelieve it. You can question the sources that it came from. You can find something else to contradict it. So and then it gets down even to the level of saying, well, this evidence is not good, this study wasn't done very well, the person that is telling me this is biased. So there's all different strategies for being able to keep on what you believe.
You raise an important question in your article about why would it make sense from an evolutionary standpoint for human beings to deny a fact right in front of them. And it turns out there, as you say in the article, there are more important things than truth for us. Explain that.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this part.
Me too.
And it's so interesting because you think like the most advantageous thing is just to believe what is true. But it's really not the case all the time. Like sometimes survival is more important than truth. And like that, this is a very sort of reductive example, but like if you hear a growl in the bushes, like better to run than like even if it's just like a bunny or something, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's just, it's more important for your safety. But I think because we're not often being attacked by tigers or whatever anymore, I think the more important one is just that social support is more important than truth. You know, humans are social animals. We can't survive without each other. And your membership in the groups that you're a part of is very important. And so if everybody in your group believes something and you're not so sure, you know, if that's going to jeopardize your membership in that group, why would you be motivated to believe that?
Yeah. Yeah, I love this part, too, that we're social creatures. And so we evolved. Basically, we evolved to believe people when they said something to us because we relied on information from, you know, people about foraging and hunting and choosing a mate. I mean, we had to believe people, and we're social creatures, and that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, so actually it's not exactly that. It's like a little more complicated than that because this is how the story spread to begin with. It's kind of coming from the other side. So like because we're social creatures, like my expertise is like very valued. Like that makes me a valued member of the society. But if I can seem like an expert without actually being one, right, then I get the benefit without having to do the work.
Yeah.
And so if you believe me when I tell you something, that is good for me. That helps me out. And even more than that, a lot of the reason people are resistant to the facts is because of just what I said. Like, you know, there are people who are going to try and take advantage. Yeah. They're going to try and be charlatans and hucksters and what have you. So motivated reasoning in a lot of ways is a protection against being manipulated. So you just don't believe everything that comes along. But that also leads you to sometimes be resistant to believing the truth.
Yeah. It's a way of shielding ourselves against being manipulated. Even though it seems like this is evidence, we're not so sure because we want to protect ourselves. What? Protect our identity? Protect our reputation? What? What are we protecting, I suppose?
I mean, you know, we're protecting our worldview. I think somebody gave me a good example, right, which is if somebody says that this snake is going to hurt you, then you're pretty likely to avoid that kind of snake and not necessarily test out that theory. And the thing that where the social support really comes in is when I'm spreading these stories, maybe I really believe it too, maybe I've convinced myself, but if you believe me when I just tell you something and you don't ask me for any more evidence and you just take me at my word, then that shows that you're on my side. And so it can be kind of a litmus test for seeing who's with you and who's against you. Mm-hmm. And even if you say something outlandish and the person is just like, like, how do you know that? Like, where's that from? That still shows that they're not just going to automatically side with you.
So I get how this works in the context of religion, for example. You know, that this is not just about individuals, as you've said. This is about groups, that this is a social phenomenon going on. But it also seems to work in politics. So are you saying that basically our political beliefs have come to be as important to us as our religious beliefs?
So I would actually leave religion entirely out of it because religion is something that by its very nature requires you to believe without evidence. And so it's not really applicable to this kind of discussion. But when it comes to politics, you know, it really depends on the person. For some people, they may not care very much about politics. And if they vote Democrat or Republican, that is not something so deeply tied to who they are that they would be bothered by hearing a fact that kind of disparages one or the other. But at the same time, it's true that we've become much more polarized in this country, and there are, you know, probably more people who do feel very deeply tied to being a Democrat or Republican. You know, they don't vote cross-party as much anymore, and it's kind of all the way. And so when people are really, really entrenched in their political identity like that, then you would expect to see this.
And more, we are entrenched in our political identity. I mean, uniquely so, do you think, just in terms of history?
I mean, let's not go crazy. We've definitely been partisan before,
yeah.
And, you know, we're not having a civil war, so that probably still wins.
Right.
But the data does show that, like, since the late 19th century, the polarization between the two parties in Congress, which is how people kind of tend to measure this, has been increasing,
yeah.
Or is higher now than it was since they began collecting the data in the late 19th century.
I think a lot of people who fancy themselves liberals would be inclined to think that they're more skeptical and less inclined to and more inclined to change their mind in the face of evidence in front of them. But it doesn't seem like that's the case, that liberals and conservatives both are being fooled.
Yeah, so this is a really, really sticky point, and I'm going to try to get it right. So, this is human nature. Like, this is partially just something that humans have always done, will always do. It's inescapable.
Right.
And it is partially exacerbated by the culture. So there is that. But the conservative-liberal question is a tricky one because there are definitely been fake news stories targeted to progressives, especially since Trump took office.
Right.
And at the same time, there are some studies that show that conservatives are more susceptible to fake news. And the reason for this is that a big part of the conservative worldview is sensitivity to threat.
Mm-hmm.
And so studies have shown, and I don't have them in front of me, this is sort of me working from memory, but I believe there have been studies that show in the lab when you kind of prime people to be more sensitive to threat, then they become more conservative in the viewpoints that they espouse, just like in the lab, so obviously fairly limited. But another thing that the evolutionary psychologist that I talked to told me is that when people, you know, there's this shield against manipulation and at the same time there's people trying to manipulate you.
Yeah.
The loophole to that is information about threat. So when if somebody tells you that snake is poisonous, you are probably not going to be like, how do you know that? Like, let's look into it more because you don't want to die.
Right.
So and if you think about it, a lot of the like sort of fake news stories that have proliferated have been about threats.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of sticky point there.
There was this study that you referred to in the article where these researchers showed Trump supporters photos of crowds at President Trump's inauguration and President Obama's inauguration. What did this say? Explain this study.
Yeah,
this is really interesting.
So this is kind of a different point than the one I was just making, but it is very interesting. So in the study, you know, there's Trump is famously steamed up about the inauguration photos.
Yeah.
There was a photo set that pretty clearly showed that Obama's 2009 inauguration had a much bigger crowd than Trump's inauguration did. And in this study, they showed these two photos to Trump supporters, and they asked them two things. One, which of these photos is Trump's inauguration? And a lot of them said that the one with more people was Trump's inauguration.
Yeah.
Then they, with another set of people, they told them explicitly, this is Trump's photo, this is Obama's photo, and said, which one has more people? And not as many, but a small number of Trump supporters said that the one that Trump's had more people. And so what is interesting here, I think people have sort of framed this study as just like, wow, how can they deceive themselves in this way? Like, this is really just like the most post-truth thing I've ever seen. And what, you know, a psychologist who I talked to pointed out is that it's not really about that. It's
yeah.
not really that they really believe there's more people in Trump's photo. Like, they have eyes. They can tell what you're really asking, and what you're really asking is whose side are you on, and they are showing that they are on Trump's side.
So are they – so they're engaging with information or with reality, not as literal information or reality, more as whose side they're on, basically?
Yeah, I mean, information is tribal in many ways, and it's not, you know, I think it's hard sometimes, and I'm guilty of this as well, because, like, media organizations who are fact-checking these things, what they are concerned with is this true or is this false?
Right.
But I think for regular people who are, you know, spreading false beliefs or who may have false beliefs, it's not always about that. It's not always about the facts. The facts are just the screen that we use to talk about something else.
Okay, so set aside the inaugural photos. Does that same thing apply when you're talking about a belief in evolution?
Yeah,
or global
absolutely.
Warming? Same thing?
Yeah, I mean, each case has its own little particularities, right? Like, but in surveys, when, you know, you'll see these surveys like, oh, Americans' science knowledge is so horrible. Like, look at the percentage of these people who don't believe in evolution. That has nothing to do with whether they can understand the theory of evolution. When they check the box that says, I don't believe in evolution, it's just a way of saying I'm religious.
This is intriguing. You're right. Being intelligent and informed can often make the problem worse.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, yes. But, you know, it just makes you smarter at figuring out how to argue against the things you don't believe.
Yeah. So does fact-checking work? You know, I mentioned earlier in the program, we were talking a little bit about Snopes and some of these other, like PolitiFact, some of these fact-checking organizations. What effect does that have on all of this, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I want to caveat that a lot of the things I'm saying are like for more extreme cases,
yeah.
Right, where somebody is very deeply tied in their identity to whatever group we're talking about. And for the more average person, like, it just may not be an issue. But there has been research that shows that correcting misinformation sometimes backfires and just makes people dig in even more strongly to the things that they believed previously. And that can even be it happens in tricky ways sometimes. Like, there was a study that, you know, was telling people that the flu vaccine does not cause the flu. And then they did a quiz after and they, you know, answered correctly, yes, the flu vaccine does not cause the flu.
Right.
However, they were still less likely to actually say they would vaccinate their kids. So the behavior and the information don't always match up.
There's this question you ask in the article. Is the present moment really so different, or did the stakes just feel higher? After having reported this, what do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I think it is different in some ways. I mean, I think it's manifesting differently, right? I think it's manifesting differently on the internet. It's manifesting differently under the Trump presidency. But there is a very very timeless quality to this
mm-hmm.
behavior, because it is to some degree just human nature.
There's this question that you ask the social psychologist Carol Tavris. What, in fact, would get someone to change their mind about a false belief that's deeply tied to their identity? And she said, probably nothing. And said, I mean that seriously. So you have that. But then you also see in the article, you say you don't think the truth is doomed despite all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, you know, that in itself may be motivated reasoning, right? Like, I'm a journalist. I don't want to believe that truth is doomed.
Right.
But, yeah, I do, you know, we have to keep in mind that for the average person, like, who is not rabid about politics, like, it's not always going to be this way. And there are stories, right? Like, I remember the story of that kid who was he was part of a white supremacist organization, and he was the son of a white supremacist. And there was this story about how, you know, he went to college and he made all these friends from different religions and different ethnicities. And like very, very, very slowly, he came to realize that he was wrong and he changed his mind. And now he's totally on the other side. And so, and I think, you know, Daniel Shaw also left that group that eventually. And it's just a slow process. So I think, you know, if there is hope, it seems to be in this, like, slow accumulation of, like, person-to-person connections and all that. But again, for the middle ground, like, facts can make a difference.
It's Julie Beck. She's senior associate editor at The Atlantic Magazine. Her article called This Article Won't Change Your Mind is available on the magazine's website. We have a link to it on our website. She joined us from the offices of The Atlantic in Washington. Julie, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Adrian Moranville. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.